Test Case, Noah's Ark, the 10th talk in a series titled Eternal Life for Dummies, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 19, 2014, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 2, Test Case, Noah's Ark, accompanies this talk.
Okay, I want to talk about Noah's Ark today. How did we get here? We're in a series that I've entitled Eternal Life for Dummies. We've spent several weeks exploring how do you answer the question, what must I believe to be saved? And we've gone through a number of different things. And finally, we resolved it, and at the last point in that series, we resolved it to, ultimately, we must not refuse to believe anything that the Bible teaches. And how we got there, I won't retrace. In fact, we may need to talk about that some more in the future. But my contention was that any resistance to what the Bible teaches, any refusal to believe what the Bible teaches, is tantamount to rejecting the teaching of Jesus. And if Jesus is our Lord, if Jesus is the Messiah that he claims to be, it is completely inconsistent to make the claim that Jesus is my Messiah and yet say he didn't know what he was talking about with respect to particular things that he might have taught or his apostles taught, and therefore anything that the Bible might teach. So what I want to do is talk about Noah's Ark as a test case for that. That's one of the reasons I'm talking about that. And secondly, I did open my mouth last week and make some rather abstruse comments that I think were not understood. So I wanted to clarify where I was coming from last week. I do believe that God created reality. I do believe that. So I want to show you where I'm coming from. But the reason it's a test case, Noah's Ark is a good test case. I remember talking to a student years and years and years ago, and the issue of biblical inerrancy came up, and the student said, if that means you have to believe in that silly story about Noah's Ark, then I can't believe in inerrancy. And I think that sentiment is probably pretty widespread. I mean, how can any serious, rational person believe the story of Noah and his archy-archy? It just defies all credulity. So the issue then is, am I suggesting that unless we are open to the possibility that Noah floated his archy-archy with all those animals, that we cannot be saved? And my answer is, yes. So I want to talk about that a little bit. We have to start by asking the question, what's the picture of creation that lies behind in the background of Genesis 1:1? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What's the picture of the creative act? We looked at Genesis 1:1 months ago, years ago, in the context of understanding the nature of the Creator and the Creator's relationship to reality. You know, is he a wizard? Is he an author? Is he an engineer? What sort of creative act is it from the standpoint of what kind of creator is he? But we can also ask the question, what sort of creative act is it in the sense of what did that look like for the world to come into existence? There's at least two options here, and these are unlike the other options about what kind of creator he is. I'm making up those categories. Those are not live options that people debate. But these are live options that people debate here about the nature of the creative act itself. One possibility is that it's instantaneous creation. And what I mean by that, God said, let there be light, and there was instantaneously light in the form in which we know it, experience it, and recognize it today. let there be land, and there was immediately land in mature continents in exactly the way that we think about those today. Or let there be the sun and the moon, and there was a sun and a moon, the same sun and the same moon that we see when we look out there today. And it all happened instantaneously. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that God created the universe through a creative process. And one, and this is not necessarily the only one, but one, given the modern state of astrophysics, one very likely way to envision that would be that in the beginning, God created a infinitely dense singularity that went bang. And that infinitely dense singularity that went bang had built into it the laws of physics such that out of that bang spewed a universe. So that infinitely dense singularity was pregnant with the universe as we know it today. It exploded, and out of that explosion developed through a long process the stars, the galaxies, the solar systems, everything that we see when we look out. That's another way that God could have created the universe. And recognize that Genesis 1:1 does not privilege one of those pictures over the other one. All it says is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Does it say that he did it instantaneously? No. Does he say that he did it over a process that took potentially billions of years? No. Doesn't say either. It just simply doesn't address the question of what exactly is the picture back behind that. So today, we're faced with a debate, an ongoing debate, between the creation science position and, for lack of a better word, I will call them young earth creationists, even though you wouldn't necessarily have to be a young earth creationist to be someone who advocates the creation science position. And I'm going to call old earth theists, that's not their label, but that's what I'm going to call them. And they fundamentally have those two different pictures of the creative act in mind. The creation science position is largely informed by the picture of creation that it was instantaneous creation. The older theists are largely informed by the picture of creation that it was that creation and a creative process that took a long time to develop. So there are four distinctives of what I'm calling the creation science position. One is that the creation was quick. Some of them will literally advocate it happened in 6 24-hour periods. And they're just taking Genesis very, very literally and saying that happened in 6 24-hour periods. Some of them might flex with that a little bit, but what they all agree on is creation was quick. Secondly, they believe that the earth is only several thousand years old, 6,000, 10,000, but somewhere in the several thousand range rather than the several hundred billion range. Third one, in the creation science position, the reason I'm talking about creation here is that the creation science position has a consistent view of both their concept of creation and Noah's flood. So I'm going to bring these together here. The third thing that's distinctive is Noah's flood was a flood that covered the whole face of the globe and was instrumental in forming most of the globe's topography. So it was this catastrophic event that flooded the entire world, drowned every living being that wasn't in the ark, killed everything, everyone, and was so catastrophic that it split the earth's crust, it caused the Grand Canyon, it caused the oceans, it caused perhaps caused the tectonic plates underlying the continents and so on and so forth. Everything was ultimately, as we now know the globe today, was ultimately created by this catastrophe of Noah's flood. And then finally, the creation science position interprets all the geological facts that are out there as consistent with instantaneous creation, a relatively young earth, and a universal flood in the time of Noah. So that's where they stake their position and are rather firm, some would even say dogmatic, in those various positions. Now, there are certain difficulties that other people would like to point out between this young earth creationism and science, certain conflicts that exist with science. What about the stars that we see? When we look up in the sky and we see a starred sky, we see stars that astronomers tell us are billions of light years away, and we're seeing the light from those stars. So how is it that we can see those stars when it had to take the light from that star billions of years to get here to Earth so that we could see it? That seems a little odd. If the Earth is only a few thousand years old, we shouldn't be able to see those stars, right? The young Earth creationist will typically answer that question. God created the star with the rays from the light of the star already most of the way to Earth when he created the world. I mean, do you see the picture? This is instantaneous creation. This is a mature creation that he's bringing into existence. So if the whole point of creating the star is to make it visible to human beings, of course you're going to create the light most of the way to Earth when you create it. Seems a little odd to the critics on the one hand. On the other hand, what else are you going to say? I mean, how else do you explain how a star a billion light years away can be seen by us if without resorting to something like that? It fits their picture of creation. Another problem are the dating methods, carbon-14 and all the other dating methods that physicists have developed. What about that? There's no question but what those dating methods date various rocks and petrified wood and so on back into the billions of years. Well, no, I guess they don't go that far back. but they date them very far back, hundreds of thousands of years. How do we explain that if the Earth is only 1,000 years old? There, the creation scientists are prepared to say there's certain assumptions built into the carbon-14 dating. You have to assume certain constants as a part of nature. For example, we now know the half-life of carbon-14 is a certain length. What if it hasn't always been that way? What if these so-called constants in physics are not as constant as we thought they were? Logan sent me a link to a TED talk by someone who, I don't know exactly who he is or what his perspective is. He sounded like he might be kind of coming from a sort of new age perspective. But he made claims that he had gone to a certain institute in Britain having studied the measurements of the constant G, the gravitational constant G, and discovered that they kept getting different results. And he went to the curator of these measurement things and said, "How come these measurements of G are not constant?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's a little embarrassing, isn't it? That's the secret we don't like to tell people. But we solved that problem," and I don't remember exactly how he solved the problem, "but they solved the problem by making the definition of the constant relative to a phenomenon rather than a number. And that way the phenomenon stays, it always stays the same in relationship to that phenomenon, even though the number might change." Well, what the creation science people are saying is, see, we assume a constant here, but do we really know, do scientists really know that this is a constant? So they're prepared to basically take issue with the orthodoxy of modern science in order to maintain their position. Okay, what about the fossils in the rock strata? They would appear, especially when you combine that with carbon-14 dating, it would appear that the fossils in various rock strata are way older than 1,000 years. So how did they get there if the world is only as young, if the world is as young as you guys say that it is? The very look of sedimentary rock, a geologist just today will tell you, it seems quite evident that it was laid down gradually over a normal process of settling through water over time. So All of those things seem to be in tension with their position. So creation science is embracing very unorthodox scientific theories. And it's that reason, and that reason alone, I would argue, why in modern culture today, they're scorned, they're held in contempt, they're considered narrow-minded, dogmatic, and stupid. I mean, everybody knows that they're wrong, right? That's sort of the cultural attitude. Are there difficulties between the young earth creationists and the Bible? Yeah, potentially. When you look at, they read Genesis 1 as if Genesis 1 is a historical description, blow by blow, of how the universe came into existence from nothing. Is that what it is? When David was taking us through Genesis, he suggested that that's not the genre of Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is poetry. It quite evidently, it seems to me, has the structure of poetry. Its purpose is not to give us a blow-by-blow description of how the universe came into existence. Its purpose is to tell us who is the author behind the existence of the universe and why he created it, to what end he created it. Not to tell us how he did it. And if that's the case, then we are misreading Genesis 1 and the creation accounts. We are misreading them if we go on to suggest my story about how the universe came into existence has to be measured by this account. That would be to misconstrue the nature of the account itself. And isn't it also debatable whether Noah's flood, as understood from the Bible, if we look at the biblical account itself, is it necessarily the case that the account of Noah's flood is an account of a universal flood that covered the whole globe? I don't think you can be unshakably confident about that. There would be a way of reading the account of Noah's flood where it's a large flood, no doubt, but for it to be one of these ancient, large regional events that completely reshaped part of the globe, yeah, clearly that, but would it have to be a universal flood that covered the whole globe? I think to be unshakably confident about that is to have too much confidence in my interpretation. What is not a difficulty, it seems to me, that often gets pointed out by critics, is that God would be deceptive. For example, take the stars with the light rays most of the way to the earth already, even though they're billions of light years away. That would be deceptive of God to create it that way, because he would make us think that the world was older than it actually is. God wouldn't do that. The God of the Bible wouldn't do that. Of course the God of the Bible would do that. I mean, that's not a valid criticism. In fact, how on earth could anyone ever bring something into existence out of nothing and not have it have the appearance of age already? What are you going to do, if you're God, what are you going to do to create something that appears to human beings to be ageless? I mean, look at the way human intelligence works. Let's take this really infinitely dense singularity that went bang. Okay, here's this infinitely dense singularity. Where did that come from? How long did it take? What caused it? We're already going into the history of the thing, right? That's where my intellectual integrity will always take me. So my intellectual inquiry will always deceive me into thinking that reality is older than it actually is. That's a simple example, but that's just built into the nature of the concept of creation out of nothing, combined with the way human intelligence makes its inquiry. So I don't think that's a valid objection to the creation science people. Now, some explanations are odder than others. For example, if a creation science person says that the reason those rocks have fossils in them is God created, just like that instantaneously, a rock strata with fossils in it. Okay? Maybe. I mean, that's certainly nothing wrong with him doing that. But it would be odd, wouldn't it? That would be a very odd thing to do. But it's not logically impossible, and who knows what purposes God has. God does all kinds of stuff in his reality that I don't understand, that I don't know the purpose of. At the same time, he was creating these little creatures at the deep, deep, deep down depths of the ocean who are not even carbon-based organisms, isn't that right? Live in on the fumes of these hot things coming from the bottom of the ocean floor. Nobody until very, very recent history ever even knew they existed, because only now do we have the technology to go down to the depths of the ocean and observe them. You've probably seen on the internet all these amazing sights out there in the stars. Human beings have not seen them before, not until modern technology. So if we're saying, well, God can't do anything if human beings can't see it and know it and enjoy it, he wouldn't be doing that. Well, we obviously know at this point he did all kinds of things like that. God is not into efficiency. God is not practical. There's a lot of things God is not. And measuring what God would or wouldn't do by our standards just doesn't make any sense. Okay, what about the old earth theists? There's four distinctive elements of their position corresponding to the young earth theists. Creation came about through created processes rather than instantaneously, but it came about through created processes. The earth is very, very old. Noah's flood was a large regional flood, but it did not cover the entire globe, nor did it kill every being on the entire planet. That's not what happened. And fourthly, it interprets geology in such a way that is consistent with all of those. It was created through created processes, the earth is very old, and the flood was not universal. Now, are there some difficulties between old earth theism and the Bible? Well, the most significant difficulty that I see is the Bible does seem to teach quite clearly, maybe inescapably, that there was a universal flood that destroyed life around the whole globe. That's where I'm going to land for now, is I think that's true. I think that's what the Bible teaches, the universal destructive force of the flood is what the Bible has in mind. Are there any difficulties between older theism and science? Well, not really, not at the moment, and that's actually why that position is attractive to the proponents of that position, is because they've managed to reconcile the way they're reading the Bible with the modern theories in geology and physics and everything else. So it avoids, to some degree at least, all the scorn and contempt of modern culture in modern scientific orthodoxy that is directed at creation science. The old earth theists tend to avoid that scorn for the most part. Okay, what's going on here between these two positions? If my understanding of the Bible's authority is right, and I believe that my view of the Bible's authority would be consistent with Jesus' view of scriptural authority, if I'm right, then three things follow. I can assume that what the Bible actually teaches is true. I believe that the Bible is inerrant, and inerrant means not errant. It does not mean it has errors in it. Years and years and years ago, Jody and I were invited to dinner, and we were in a conversation with a young woman. She asked me about what I was teaching, and I was teaching a class on biblical inerrancy. And we went for 45 minutes of me explaining the content of my class, and she got angrier and angrier and angrier until finally, at the end of the 45 minutes, she said, well, if the Bible is inerrant, name one. And finally, it became clear to me. She thought I meant inerrant meant the Bible had errors in it. And I had to explain to her, no, inerrant means that I believe the Bible does not have any errors in it. In is a negation, a particle of negation. So I can assume that what the Bible actually teaches is true if it is inerrant in the way that I think that it is. Secondly, I can assume that the facts of physics, chemistry, astronomy, geology, and biology are true. Because if it is inerrant, it is describing all of reality, nature, physics, chemistry, every aspect of reality. It's describing it as it is. So there's two ways for me to know what is. I can go look and see what is, and see that these are the laws of physics, these are the laws of chemistry, these are biological principles, and so on. I can see that with my own eyes, doing my own research, and that's getting me in touch with what's true about reality. That's one way of knowing. Another avenue for knowing is to know what I can know from the Bible and understand it, interpret it rightly, and whatever it says is true is true. Both of those things are avenues toward truth. Therefore, if the Bible is actually inerrant, as I believe that it is, then there will not be and there cannot be any conflict between the teaching of the Bible and the facts of science. They will be completely and totally compatible with one another. To put it another way, there will never be any conflict between accurate understanding of the faith and sound reasoning about reality. Faith and reason are not in conflict. Now, that's not unique to me, but there have been many people who have made that claim. But it has never been really the most popular position, because Christian culture has always tended to go, if reason fails you, then you just believe something by faith. And they put themselves in a position where there's no compunction to believe against reason, because that's what God wants me to do. That's what makes me spiritual. That's what makes me loyal to God, is to believe against my own reason because the Bible tells me to, or God tells me to do that. I'm arguing that doesn't make any sense. If the Bible really truly is the inerrant word of God that's giving me the truth and nothing but the truth, then that should necessarily line up with the truth that I find when I go look at reality itself. They will be completely compatible with each other. However, obviously, my interpretation of the Bible is not infallible, right? I can be wrong when I read the biblical text and I make certain assumptions about the text and I interpret it in a certain way. I might have it right, but I could also have it wrong. And I may need to go back to the drawing board and take another look at it. Have I read this correctly? So the account of Noah's Ark. We have been trained through our whole life to read Noah's Ark as a universal flood. But what if that's not what the account is saying? If I really want to believe the Bible, I need to go back and find out what is the biblical account really actually claiming and asserting. Not what do I think it's asserting, but what is it actually asserting? So I have to accept the fact that my interpretation of the Bible is not infallible. Also, science's interpretation of physical reality is not infallible either. And that should be a no-brainer if we have any sort of perspective on history at all and look at all the various scientific revolutions that have happened over the course of Western civilization. What we used to think was scientific is no longer scientific. What we used to think science taught us, we no longer think that it teaches us. Why? Because we've changed our interpretation with new facts, new data, new information, and another way of looking at it. We've decided that this other way of looking at it is a better take on reality than what we used to think. So science is no more infallible than am I as a Bible interpreter. So, how should a disciple of Jesus determine the truth in matters where science and the Bible speak to the same reality? Well, the thing that makes the most sense is I enter into a dialectical process, a back and forth. I go and look at the Bible and try my best to understand what it's saying, and I go to nature and science and try to understand what makes the most sense there. And if I believe, as a disciple of Jesus, if I believe that those are completely compatible and totally reconcilable, I will use what makes sense to me out of science to help me rethink my biblical interpretation. But I will also use what I am confident is a good biblical interpretation to help me sort through and sift through what I will and will not accept in the theories of modern science. and I'm going to go back and forth in a dialect between the two. When what the Bible teaches is in conflict with what science teaches, then I will and must reconsider my interpretation of science's interpretation of an understanding of nature. So the Bible and science are not in conflict, are in conflict. I have to reconsider what I think science is saying if I'm confident that I've got my Bible right. So I'm going to put more confidence in the Bible if I'm confident to the degree that I'm confident of my interpretation. And to that degree, I will be willing to bet that science has some things to learn, that science doesn't have all this stuff down yet. That's exactly what the young earth creationism is doing. They are confident that their interpretation of the Bible is accurate, and they have the same perspective on biblical authority that I have. They have a perspective that I think they ought to have. So, believing that the two should be reconcilable, your science and your Bible, they are willing to say science doesn't have it all right yet. And they're in the process of trying to rethink their science in the light of what they know is true in the Bible. That's a completely intelligent, a completely reasonable, and an intellectually responsible thing to do. There's nothing irrational about it. There's nothing unscientific about it. They might be wrong, but they're not idiots, and they're not charlatans, and they're not intellectually irresponsible. Given their confidence in the interpretation of the Bible, they're approaching it in exactly the right kind of way. Where I have a problem with creation science is in none of those things I just mentioned. I think they are being fully responsible in their reconciling science and the Bible. My problem is I don't think their interpretation of the Bible is right, at least their interpretation of the creation accounts. I don't think they have that right. And so they hammer their stake in the ground, and they're not going to move on an interpretation of the creation accounts that I don't think is justified to be that firm and dogmatic about. Well, what the Bible teaches is in conflict with what science teaches, then I must reconsider my interpretation of the biblical text if I'm confident that science has it right. So if I have greater confidence in the scientific theories when it comes into conflict with the Bible, then I would use my confident grasp of the scientific theories to force me to go back and reread my Bible and reconsider how I'm interpreting it. To do so is not disrespectful of biblical authority. That's what the creation science people tend to accuse their critics of, is that, well, you just don't believe. You don't believe in biblical authority. Well, not necessarily. There's nothing unbelieving or secular or godless about the approach that someone has taken. If they think that geology has it right, then doesn't that become a fixed point from which to go back and reconsider my understanding of the biblical text? Yeah, that's the intelligent thing to do, and that's what you ought to do. They might be wrong. Maybe their confidence is misplaced. Maybe they're placing confidence in science that is not well-founded. But what they're doing is not unbelieving or rebellious in any way. They're just doing the intelligent thing, given their assumption that science must have this one right. Now, where I have a problem with some of the older theists is that I do think that their confidence in science can be very naive. They don't have a good historical perspective. They don't recognize that science has developed and evolved and changed in radical ways over the course of history, and so they lose perspective on how fallible science can be. And so they're too unguarded. They're overly confident with respect to the theories of modern science. Now, what if, with equal confidence, I think science is right in some respect, and with equal confidence, I think this is in fact what the Bible teaches, and they're in conflict? Okay, we would ultimately get to the point where we would have to reconsider whether the Bible even is the authority that I am arguing that it is. We may even have to get to the point where we have to reconsider whether Jesus really is the Messiah that he claimed to be. I've got a whole lot of rethinking to do if, in fact, I find that the Bible and science are irreconcilably in conflict, and they just are in conflict. Because that ought not to be if the Bible really is the Word of God, then they should never come into conflict. Now, there's plenty of reasons to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and there's reasons to think the Bible has that kind of authority. So what we would actually do in a situation like that, you know, I would hope that we would go cautiously rather than be hasty in that regard. Because we need to have the humility to know, I may not know my Bible correctly, and science may not have the world right. So just sit in that place of humility and go, I don't know. I don't know why they're in conflict, but I've got to wait and see till something gives. So with respect to Noah's flood, there's two critical questions. Well, with respect to the debate between the young earth creationists and the older theists, do Genesis 1 and 2 require an instantaneous creation like creation science says? If it does, to bring it now back to the point at hand, as a disciple of Jesus, I dare not reject that. If this is what the Bible teaches, and therefore is what Jesus and the apostles would support and subscribe to, I dare not refuse to believe what they themselves believe, even if it makes me look like a blooming idiot to my culture. Then that's what I need to do. And likewise, I must ask whether the facts of science cannot be understood differently in that regard. The second question is, does the account of Noah's flood require that we understand the flood to be universal? If it does, then I must not reject that, no matter how silly it might sound to everybody else around me. If that's what the Bible teaches, that's what the Bible teaches. And that's the worldview that we are committing ourselves to. That's what our teacher and our Lord has taught us, and we must bow the knee to that. Now, my answer to those questions is that I don't think that the Genesis accounts do require an instantaneous creation. So right now, as I sit right now, I lean more toward an old earth perspective than a young earth perspective, because I don't think there's really anything in the Bible that requires the earth to be young. Nothing that requires that. With respect to Noah's flood, on the one hand, all the relevant statements and facts interpreted in a certain way could be understood to be compatible with a very large regional flood that affected the whole region surrounding what is the historical home of the Jews. So it could be something happening in the Levant region, and that's what the Bible teaches. That's what it means. Even 2 Peter 3, which would be a critical passage in this regard, let me just read the relevant portion of that. But even 2 Peter 3 could be consistent with it being a regional flood, I think. Know this, first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. So notice what they're saying. The mockers and the scoffers are coming along after a lifetime of nature being very, very regular and saying, dude, things like worldwide floods just don't happen. I mean, they don't happen, period. So Peter says, for when they maintain this, the regularity of nature, when they maintain the regularity of nature, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. And by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. So one very obvious way of reading this would be that Peter's drawn in an analogy. There was a time in which a significant event in the history of the world was a watershed event. The world was one way before that event and was a radically different way after that event. That was Noah's flood. And it changed everything, and it altered everything. Well, believe me, he says, when I tell you another watershed event is going to happen. The heavens and the earth as you know it now are going to be destroyed, and they're going to be replaced with a completely different heavens and a different earth. That'll be a watershed event in cosmic history. Well, if you're going to appeal to the regularity of nature, you've got to remember nature was not always so regular. I can point to a watershed event in history. So if there's one, there can be another one. And the prophecy is that there will be another one. Okay, now, the problem is, that appears to be his argument, but could his argument be not that the flood transformed the entire globe, but that it was simply a monumental event and had a monumental impact on a certain people and the history of a certain people and so on? Well, you could make that analogy too, that this people had their whole life transformed and there was a watershed event in this people group. Well, similarly, every person is going to see a watershed event where this heavens and earth is destroyed and a new one is coming. Could be. That's not impossible. I'm not inclined to think so. And that's why, as I sit here today, I'm inclined to think that Noah's flood was universal. It was it wiped out every living being on the entire planet. So that's where I lean. But I do so with hopefully the humility to realize that there's a lot I don't know. And maybe science will eventually come up with some kind of argument. I haven't seen it yet, but some kind of argument that makes that an impossible scenario. If so, then I'd have to go back to the drawing board on looking at the Genesis accounts of Noah's flood. Okay, I have more than exhausted what I have to say. What are your questions and comments and objections and complaints?
Jack, I think for me at least the key to really understanding science and the Bible and so on is basically your core belief. In other words, you can look at scientific facts, and if you have a belief system that has an absolute, it will definitely determine how you interpret events. And like, for instance, I can go to evolution in a Christian. Their basic core determines how they interpret. Like I may say, oh, isn't this wonderful what God's done? Others would say, oh, yeah, this is a process. It took millions and millions of years and so on. And I see that as a key to really understanding. And I think both views, the old theist and many of the creationists, is they're not trying to be perfectly honest with themselves and looking at it fully. In other words, what I'm saying is, like, for instance, like one of the things with creationism, with like Genesis, is that science clearly shows some things that put into question the actual 7 days. But I, as a Christian, accept creation that the order is correct, whereas evolution says that's not the way the order happened.
You understand the order, saying? The chronological order?
Well, no. Well, chronological order, like for instance, one of the criticism evolution has is that the Bible has the appearance of birds as totally wrong.
I'm sorry, it has the what?
Birds. Birds as totally wrong.
Okay.
Evolution has it much later.
Yeah, no disagreement. What our core assumptions are going to affect everything. So, for example, when it comes to evolution, there's no way in the world I can be a evolutionist in the sense of what you see in the museums and the biology classes of our culture today. I'm a divine determinist, for goodness sake. Everything is caused by God. There is no such thing as randomness. So the God chance that they say is the creator of the world, I don't believe in that God. I don't think that God exists. I don't think that God is even a competent God. The God who exists is the author of all reality, every iota of it. He determines everything. Now, could there be an evolutionary process where you have a single cell organism and it gets more and more complex and becomes an ape like me? Yes, but only by design. Only if the creator designed the creative processes that could have given rise to that, and that was his intention to do so, and every stage along the way he was creating the process along the way. Well, that's not randomness, right? So the thing that typical modern evolutionary theory appeals to, there's no way in the world I can accept that. Not if I have the view of God that I think the Bible teaches.
Yeah, well, I was just trying to say, if I can pick a creationist, it's their dogmatic belief that their interpretation is 100% right. I don't mean to toot my horn, but one view I take on the creation story is I may not understand completely what is meant by a day. And I may not completely understand what it was like when God said, you know, put the sun, that there was light. These are things that I can't completely understand and that I can't be dogmatic about.
Right. Yeah, along those lines. A lot of people will say things like, well, a day doesn't really mean a day. It may mean a period of time or something like that. We don't even need to go there. What does a day mean in Genesis? I think it means a day. There's evening and there's morning. There's one day. The problem is not the meaning of the word. The problem is, what are we reading here? We're reading a poem. And so the question is not how long is the day. The question is, what does the day represent in the poetry of Genesis 1? And I think what it represents is I haven't thought about this enough, so I won't be able to articulate it accurately, but it's a movement in the poem and a movement that represents the logic of the creative act. And the day is being used to talk about each movement of the logic of the creative act. It has nothing to do with length of time, chronology, or anything of the sort, if we get the genre right, it seems to me.
In summary, would you say that your position is that God is granting eternal life to those who are humble and seeking the truth no matter where it goes or where it lays?
Yes, and that we are not, and this comes back to where this started last week, we are not so intimidated by our culture that we will ultimately refuse to believe what the Bible teaches because that's not going to gain me acceptance in my culture. I think that's ultimately deadly. Now, there's all kinds of ways to make that mistake, ignorance, bad reasoning, and so on, that does not damn me. You know, so we may find ourselves drawn to the culture, but we make mistakes that are basically innocent mistakes. I'm not being defiant. I'm not being rebellious. I'm not being hardened against the truth of God, but I just don't get there for a variety of reasons. That's fine. Those are forgivable sins. The unforgivable sin, when I basically tell God to stick it in his ear, because I don't respect him enough to listen to him. That's the unforgivable sin.
So I thought maybe this would be a good opportunity. Obviously, I haven't been here. I mean, I vaguely remember you people. It's been quite a while that Robbie and I have been gone, so I haven't heard most of your series, actually. Sorry about that. So you've probably talked about this all kinds, but there's an issue involved in the general theme here that I thought this might be a good opportunity to ask you to clarify. And you used the word ultimately there, and that's really at the heart of my question. I do lots of things in my life that are not innocent. That is, I make choices along the way. I believe wrong things. I do wrong things. I want wrong things. Not innocently, but because I'm still wrestling with my own sin, and my sin can lead me to fear, and my sin can lead me to want things that I probably shouldn't, but I find myself drawn to them anyway. And
you
so
just
forth.
Need to cut it out.
Good. Okay. Well, that does answer the question. So I've mentioned this many times, and you have too, but there's the example of Jesus talking about how if you deny me before the Father, before men, I will deny you before the Father. And then we look at Peter, who denied him. And there's no question at that spot, it wasn't an innocent thing exactly. I mean, he was afraid that he was going to die, and he denied Jesus. So it seems to me, I mean, the way I look at this stuff is that the picture that we have in the Bible of the sorts of issues that we have to face is kind of like describing the terrain of the territory. This is the kind of thing that I'm going to have to battle my way through to be a believer. But we see in the example of Peter that at any given spot, my life might not look like the thing that is being described. I'm not supposed to deny Jesus, but in fact, Peter did. So it seems to me that a genuine believer could find themselves in a position, because they are sinners and they are wrestling with these things, that they might actually be afraid to be ridiculed by people who believe in evolution or something like that. And it's not just innocent, it's that I'm afraid to go there because of the consequences that might come along. But it doesn't represent an ultimate telling God to stuff it or whatever it is you said. It's that wrestling with myself, my genuine desire to follow God, with my weakness and fear that gets in the way of my sorting out what that's about. Yeah. So that we're talking about issues that we're going to face that will be tests, that will be trials, that will trouble us, that we may stumble and fail in, but that ultimately all of those different things are ways of describing the kinds of things that ultimately will not keep me from following God. So I guess I would just like to say, it seems to me that given the thing that you're describing, that a Christian could have a current lack of desire to look stupid in the eyes of my culture and be afraid to go where the Bible's taking me, and yet not ultimately be hostile to God, but just in the midst of that test and trial.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Peter denied Jesus, he wept, and came back. That's fine. That's forgivable. To deny Jesus and walk the other direction and keep going, that's the unforgivable sin. Yeah.
This, actually, you might know the answer to this. Has it been calculated if all of the ice mass on Earth were melted, how much that would cover? Has anyone done that?
I'm not sure. The book that I just finished reading suggests that there's no way that would have covered the entire globe as we know it. But see,
we don't know what's moved. And
yeah. I mean, how high were the mountains in Noah's day? I don't know. My contention would be, I don't see how geology can ever disprove Noah's flood. How could it ever disprove it? Because what would have to disprove it is to reconstruct history, to reconstruct the actual story of how this thing went down. All the geology in the world is not going to be able to give you enough information to reconstruct the actual story and the actual history. It can give me pieces of it. I mean, this book all you guys know this, but this book that I was reading, it's called The Rocks Don't Lie, which is a problem, because of course the rocks lie if you interpret them wrongly. But he tells this fascinating story about how Eastern Washington was formed, that there was an ancient Lake Missoula that would periodically, about every 10 years, be dammed by a glacier until enough water behind the glacier floated the glacier, and then you had this torrential flood every 10 years that would come sweeping down the Columbia Basin. It actually filled up part of the Willamette Valley. So, I mean, it's amazing. And the guy who presented that theory was mocked and scorned and held in contempt his whole life, until finally in his 90s he was given an award, because finally the evidence had come in that he was absolutely right, that he had nailed it. But it was going enough against orthodoxy, because the orthodoxy was, no, catastrophes like that don't happen at the time. And this guy showed that, no, really, really huge, significant catastrophes happen. And that's partly what explains the geology here. Yeah, even if the polar ice caps all melted and that wouldn't be enough to cover the Earth now, that doesn't tell me what might have been true in Noah's day. I just don't know.
There are certain elements in the Genesis accounts in creation and in Noah and in even the story of Balaam's ass that, you know, that these are just unbelievable, that people say. I think, well, there's what few creation myths I've read
tell us how we got here, but they don't tell us why, except for the Genesis account. Mm-hmm. It kind of seems to tell us why. And that should leap off the page as making that a different account. The implications of the story of Noah are that it begins with God saying, man is evil. The whole earth is filled with his evil. So that's an implication of the story of Noah that really needs to be considered, because if it's a package deal, if the story is a package deal, can I accept that, yeah, mankind's evil, and reject the story of what God did about it? Because it seems it all flows together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I wonder how many times that is actually the secret agenda behind people who don't want to believe the account. It's not because they could be convinced that a catastrophic event really did get recorded, as we are told many cultures have the story of the flood, but that the implication is mankind is evil and worth wiping off the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if I believe one, I have to believe the other.
Okay.
I'll run it by you and see. When I was a kid in L.A. growing up, we had phonograph stories of Noah's story and all the animals going up. And you could say, oh, those are the same animals that I see in the zoo. But then one day we went on a field trip to the La Brea, I think it was La Brea, tar pits. And there were saber-toothed tigers and everything else hanging out there, and at least what's left of them. And so, and I still haven't put all of that together. I guess the dinosaurs and it just does not fit. A lot of what you said today, I've heard that presented in a similar, but I still can't get these prehistoric dinosaurs fit into any idea of reality, I guess.
Yeah, no, exactly. I can't either. And again, how would we be able to piece all that together? Only if somehow, somewhere, somebody could tell us the story of the earth. It's entirely possible that dinosaurs came, went, and gone. See, if I'm right that the earth might be older than a few thousand years old, it could be that you have a whole history on this earth before the history that the Bible is interested in even begins. It's entirely possible. At least I don't see how it's not entirely possible. So it may very well be that dinosaurs are really completely irrelevant to the whole biblical account, and their only relevance is oil and fossils. It's what makes Los Angeles run, you know.
There are a lot of things about Noah's flood that are really problematic, but don't let the quantity of water have anything to do with it. Because if you think about it, it does say in the Bible that the water rose. It doesn't say that the land didn't sink. And imagine for a second if you took all of the Himalayan mountains and put them in a dump truck and drove down to Marianas Trench and dumped them in. Okay, well, that would take a lot of it down below sea level, and the sea level would now rise based on filling up that hole. So if all the mountains were laid down and all the valleys were filled up, you could cover the whole thing with water that way. So it's not a volume of water issue, but there are lots of other things. It's just I couldn't let that one go.
Yeah, no, thank you. Good.
A couple thoughts about Noah's time. And just because the Bible insinuates that it didn't rain before that, there was water. And so there was probably people with boats that fished. So I think that would require a universal flood. And otherwise, you know, let's get in the boat. We got fishing tackle and nets. Let's go. So, and then the other thing would be, why build an ark if you weren't going to flood the entire earth? You could just send Noah and the animals to high ground.
Yeah, it would depend upon how significant and how vast the flood was, I would think.
Well, I think it would have to be also very violent to take care of any small fishing boats that would be trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier you mentioned that strata of sediment with the fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that help substantiate the flood?
Well, the creation science people have a count about how the fossils were formed quickly by the flood. That's true. That's not without its problems. So, for example, why do we not have human remains fossilized in the same way? Because we don't seem to have that. So that's not without its problems, but that's what they propose as a different scientific theory. Yeah.
And then as far as creation in 1:1, when he says the earth was created formless and void, well, couldn't there be a billion years between that and when he began the six-day creation story? Couldn't all that be in existence, but not like we know it today?
Yeah, and over the course of history, that's been not infrequently proposed. They call it the gap theory, that between verse 1 and verse 2, there's this very, very, very long gap in time. Again, I don't think that's necessary, though, to propose that, given the genre of Genesis 1. I mean, if it's not dealing with chronology at all, you don't really need more time. You don't need to find it in the text. Yeah. So, could be, but I'm personally not inclined to go there.
Yeah, I was just thinking of the carbon dating. Well, I guess there wouldn't be carbon, would there?
Well, no, I mean, the science behind what you're suggesting is, I'm inclined to think that the Earth really is, don't trust me on numbers, but billions of years, hundreds of thousands of years old, I'm inclined to think that that's true. Okay. And that's why the carbon dating works, is because it really is as old as the carbon dating says that it is. But, so there.
Good answer.
Yeah, deal with it.
So I don't have a Bible in front of me, shame on me, but there, at the end of the flood when he sends out the dove, I think that was kind of problematic last time I read it because it sounded like, how quickly can this tree grow? Because it's actually an olive leaf, you know, that it brings back, and it's only maybe a month or so, I think it was. Don't quote me on that. How do you explain that, you know, just being able to have the dove go out and find a tree that's budded and, you know, bloomed and everything in that short period of time?
Yeah.
I mean, does that mean that maybe it wasn't covered, you know, that there was something that survived?
Yeah, forester, not here, or a gardener. If you have a plant submerged for about a year, what will it? Will it kill it? How about an olive tree? I submerge all of our plants for a year. I have not looked at the account in that kind of detail. That I can't really answer that. I did, as I looked at it again, it did occur to me that we really have to be careful to ask ourselves the question, what exactly is being said here? We quickly jump to conclusions. It talks about what was the first bird? Raven? The raven just not coming back, right?
I think that, isn't the dove that doesn't come back at the end, or... Is it?
Right.
Yeah, so they brings back the olive leaf, and then it doesn't come back at all, so it's found like a...
And the way it puts it is, it could find no place to put its feet, I believe is how it's worded. Well, you got a whole ark there, dude. that has to be an idiom for something that doesn't... Where our minds go is there's nothing but water, there's literally nothing to light on. To get any rest. I doubt if that's what it means. I think probably what it means is more something like there just is no place for a suitable nest. Doesn't mean it can't light. It just means there's no place yet for a suitable nest. So, or something like that. But we have to be really careful to go in and ask ourselves the question, what exactly is this story? What exactly is being said here? It's written in an ancient language, in an ancient idiom with ancient metaphors. And we're clueless about that. We'd have to reconstruct them. So we shouldn't jump to conclusions about, well, that's what this means. Maybe, but what if it meant something else? The same thing with the animals. Even if it is a universal flood, and I'm inclined to think that it was, did he literally have a pair of every animal on the face of the globe? I don't think the text requires that. Because all the time the Bible will talk about all or every, but there's implicitly a domain in view. All of the things in this domain, all of the things in this set of things. So it may very well be that what he had all of were all the animals that were at all relevant to the life of a man like Noah in his time and place in history. That may be all that it means. Clean and unclean, that's relative to me, right? So there's clean and unclean, and then the crawling creatures. Well, what if crawling creatures, crawling things, is a technical term that we have lost sight of the meaning of, that was another category of animals relevant to the life of somebody in Noah's day? Then we have three categories of animals, and does that exhaust all of zoology? Not necessarily. There's nothing that requires that. Debbie.
Thanks, Jack. This is really fascinating. Do you think Moses wrote this, right?
I'm sorry?
Moses wrote this book?
Well, compiled it.
Compiled it.
Yeah. It's probably a more ancient account than than Moses.
I'm just curious if you think that he or any of his source material, if those people knew how the world was created and then wrote a poem about it, or did they not know either?
I don't think so. That's why I think Genesis 1 is not telling us how, because who knew?
I mean, I would assume that they were all flat earth people, right? I mean, they didn't know back then that the earth is round. And
probably.
You know, I mean, their assumptions in the Bible was written with the assumptions of the science of the day, whatever that was. The earth is flat. Those things that we now know are not true.
Yeah, as long as, but we have to be careful there. I mean, that's true. We have to be careful there because, yes, they wrote it from a standpoint of the consciousness of that day, including the scientific assumptions of that day. That's true, but they're not necessarily supporting and asserting the scientific assumptions of that day. Where that really comes in is, take David writing a psalm talking about the sun moving across the sky. Well, did David think that it's actually the sun that moves rather than the earth turning? Probably. Does the psalm assert that the sun moves and the earth does not rotate? No. I mean, the language is coming out of that kind of phenomenological experience, and he probably had certain theories that he would use to explain that. But all he's talking about is the phenomenon, not the scientific theory. And so the same thing would be true in Genesis. They're not proposing a theory about how the world came to be. It's a theological poem. It's a poem to teach us about God. It's a poem to teach us about reality and relationship to God and man's place in that reality. That's what it's for. And given that, we mustn't assume that it's asserting a particular kind of scientific theory. Yeah, we still say sunrise and sunset. One more, and then I'll let you go.
It's kind of a silly question, maybe, but if you're saying that Noah took into the ark those animals that were relevant to his immediate reality, well then, and it was a whole earth flood, then where'd we get elephants and tigers and platypuses and kangaroos? And well, you know what I mean? I'm just saying that those are all from different areas of the world, and they would have not been in existence if they weren't on the ark.
Right.
So where'd they come from?
Yeah, well, that's a problem. I mean, we do know, remember, I already said that I reject the whole notion of evolution as something that happened by random mutations, by random chance and so on. But we do know from biology that there's incredible diversity built into the genomes of different species. And out of these different species come all kinds of different... I mean, just look at what we've done breeding dogs. The St. Bernard and the Mexican Chihuahua. They're both dogs. They're all coming out of the same gene pool. They're all part of the same... help me, I'm way out of my field, but species or whatever the right term is. But they're coming from the same place. So all you would need is two of whatever those are. And out of that can come this wide, wide variety that we see today and we recognize today. Now, that's through human breeding, but Darwin was right in this respect, that a lot of that variety occurs naturally through things like natural selection, circumstances, environment, and so on. I mean, we know that's true. So
it would take a really, really long time. So how does the creation scientist even deal with that? Because it would have had to have taken more than 2,000 years to evolve an elephant out of a mouse or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah, I don't, well, an elephant.
Well, maybe not, mouse. I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't know enough about that. But if that's a problem, then that's a problem. I mean, if there really isn't enough time for that, that'd be a problem. Thank you. I need to let you go.